August 31st from 8 to 10 at the Parks Dining Hall. Bring your own plates and utensils to help the environment. And looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy skies, lows 41 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76, overnight lows in the low 50s. And Wednesday, mostly sunny with highs 75 to 80 degrees, slight chance of rain in the afternoon.
Our contention is that they can't send him to any one of the other 200 countries on Earth unless that country is given credible assurances that he'll be allowed to have a legal status.
Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was wrongfully deported to El Salvador, now faces possible deportation to Uganda.
For Monday, August 25th, it's All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. After sending the National Guard to Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., President Trump suggests that Chicago is next.
We may or may not. We may just go in and do it, which is probably what we should do.
Also, an NPR investigation into a new member of the Justice Department group that's targeting the alleged weaponization of law enforcement.
And musician Marcus Brown has a new album that draws inspiration from Baltimore, where he grew up.
You're never going to find, like, more creative and just more interesting and, like, intelligent people that probably don't know they're those things.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker was in Chicago today, where he slammed President Trump's threat to make the city the next target in his crackdown on crime.
Today in the Oval Office, Donald Trump looked at the assembled cameras and asked for me personally to say, "Mr. President, can you do us the honor of protecting our city?" Instead, I say, "Mr. President, do not come to Chicago."
This morning, Chicago's Democratic mayor, Brandon Johnson, told NPR that his city is not calling for American troops to occupy American cities. At the White House today, Trump signed a series of executive orders, including one that would create a specialized National Guard unit that could be deployed to assist local law enforcement. And the White House said today that the deployment of Guard troops and federal law enforcement in Washington, D.C., has led to more than 1,000 arrests and more than 100 firearms seized. The leader of one of Mexico's most notorious drug cartels has pleaded guilty to criminal charges in U.S. federal court. Ismael Zampata Garcia, known as El Mayo, was perhaps Mexico's biggest drug lord. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas reporting.
For decades, El Mayo Zampata was a leader of the Sinaloa cartel, which he helped found along with Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. U.S. authorities arrested Zampata last summer, and he was facing charges in federal court in Brooklyn. Now, Zampata has pleaded guilty to leading a continuing criminal enterprise and racketeering conspiracy. Attorney General Pam Bondi says this is a major win against the drug cartels.
El Mayo will spend the rest of his life behind bars. He will die in a U.S. federal prison where he belongs.
Zampata's Sinaloa cartel co-founder, El Chapo, is already serving a life sentence in U.S. prison. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
On to the economy. A new survey of business economists finds widespread concern about the Trump administration interfering with the Federal Reserve. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the results. As the president and his allies have been waging a high-pressure campaign for the central bank to lower interest rates.
Economists surveyed by the National Association for Business Economics have a range of ideas about where interest rates should end up this year, but a large majority say the White House should stay out of it. Nearly 8 out of 10 economists surveyed say they're very or somewhat concerned about political interference with Fed policymaking. More than 3 out of 4 say the president should play no role in the Fed's interest rate decisions. President Trump has been outspoken in criticizing the central bank for not moving more aggressively to cut rates. Trump also threatened to fire a member of the Fed's governing board, even though by law, Fed governors can only be removed for cause. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News. The man who was mistakenly deported to the notorious Cicot prison in his home country of El Salvador is back in federal custody. Kilmar Garcia Abrego was detained this morning, just days after being freed from a detention facility in Tennessee to await trial on human smuggling charges. A federal judge today extended a temporary restraining order barring the government from deporting him again, this time to Uganda. There will be no public tours of the White House next month. NPR's Tamara Keith reports on President President Trump's launch of a major renovation, building a ballroom on the east side of the White House.
The White House has many functions: residence, office, and living museum, visited by thousands of people every year, with members of Congress distributing tour slots to their constituents. Republican Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania tweeted that as of September 1st, White House tours are paused until further notice. A White House official who was not authorized to speak on the record confirms that the tours are temporarily paused in September, with more details to come regarding future months. Trump recently announced a $200 million ballroom project, which will affect areas typically included in the public tours. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Now to Los Angeles, where police have charged rapper and singer Lil Nas X with four felonies. The charges include three counts of battery on a police officer. Authorities say Lil Nas X charged at officers who confronted him last week as he walked nearly naked down a Los Angeles street. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $160,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit KAXE.org. Now back to All Things Considered.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly in New York.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The future of Kilmar Abrego Garcia is uncertain at this hour. The Maryland man was wrongfully deported by the Trump administration to El Salvador back in March. He later returned to the U.S., and just this morning, he was taken into custody during an immigration check-in. Now, the U.S. government is trying to deport him to Uganda, something that his attorneys are calling a, quote, vindictive act of retribution. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has been following this long-running case and joins us now. Hi, Sergio.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, just first remind us, why is this case involving Abrego Garcia especially important at this moment?
Yeah, at the core of this case are questions about due process under President Trump's ongoing crackdown on undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. Abrego Garcia came from El Salvador to the U.S. illegally in 2011 when he was 16. He alleges he was escaping gang death threats there. He has not been convicted of any crimes. But Abrego Garcia was arrested during a traffic stop in Maryland in March and 3 days later was sent to a notorious prison in El Salvador. And that is despite a 2019 immigration court ruling barring his deportation there, his home country, because of what the judge called well-founded fear of gang persecution. Now, the Trump administration admitted that Abrego Garcia's removal was an administrative error. He was brought back to the U.S. in June to face new unrelated charges of human smuggling. He has pleaded not guilty to those charges and was released from federal custody on Friday pending the criminal trial. That same day, he received a notice from ICE indicating he was going to be detained again.
Right. And today he presented himself to a mandatory ICE check-in and was, I understand, immediately taken back into immigration custody. Can we just listen to his lawyer here? This is Simon Sandoval Moschenberg speaking earlier today.
The only reason that they've chosen to take him into detention is to punish him. To punish him for exercising his constitutional rights. His constitutional right to fight back against being illegally deported to El Salvador.
Okay, Sergio, is he likely to be sent out of the country again?
So, Elsa, based on a prior court order, the earliest he could be removed is on Wednesday. Okay. But earlier today, Abrego Garcia's lawyers were in court arguing to postpone that date while they fight the detention and deportation efforts. And the federal judge in Maryland, in the Maryland hearing, the challenge said she is inclined to push that date, meaning she is expected to halt Abrego Garcia's deportation until at least this Friday. She also ordered Abrego Garcia not to be moved from the Virginia Detention Center where he's now being held. And she has asked for another hearing on Friday.
Okay. Well, I saw that Abrego Garcia talked to reporters earlier today as he was preparing to enter his check-in with ICE in Baltimore. What did he say exactly?
Yeah, I mean, he was received by a big group of supporters who were rallying for him outside the Baltimore ICE building. There, he said, spending the last few days with his family gave him hope.
A toda la familia también que han sufrido separaciones.
To all the families who have also suffered separations or who live under the constant threat of being separated, Abrego Garcia said, I want to tell you that even though this injustice is hurting us hard, we must not lose hope. He said this while flanked by his wife, members of his union, and religious leaders.
Hmm. Well, finally, I just want to ask you, why Uganda? I mean, as we've mentioned, he's from El Salvador originally, right?
Right. I mean, he has no connection to Uganda, but the Trump administration has an agreement with the country. Officials there have said they are open to receiving deportees as long as they don't have a criminal record. Abrego Garcia has been indicted, but has not been convicted of any crimes. The Trump administration has also accused him of being a member of the MS-13 gang, something he has repeatedly denied. Now, the U.S. government did offer Abrego Garcia a deportation to Costa Rica in exchange of a guilty plea on all the charges and serving the imposed sentence in the U.S., but he did not. Take it.
That is NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran. Thank you so much, Sergio.
You're welcome.
After sending the National Guard into Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., President Trump has eyes on Chicago. Friday, he suggested the Windy City would be next. Here he is today speaking from the Oval Office.
We may or may not. We may just go in and do it, which is probably what we should do.
Chicago's Democratic mayor and the Democratic governor of Illinois are united in opposition to this idea. So, too, is Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. He represents Illinois' 8th District, which includes part of Chicago and its northwest suburbs. He's on the line from Chicago. Congressman, welcome.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mayor Louise.
So we just heard the president say he hasn't made a final decision. He also suggested he would wait for Governor Pritzker to ask for his help, which does not seem likely given Governor Pritzker's opposition to this whole thing. How real, how imminent do you think this is?
I think we have to take it seriously. I think that he desperately wants to distract from his problems with the management of the economy, as well as the Epstein files. And this is the latest in a series of efforts to distract from those problems. And so we have to take it very seriously.
I was seeing your post on X that Trump's plan is, and I'm quoting your words, illegal and reckless. Just read us a little bit more into your thinking on it.
Sure. There's a doctrine called posse comitatus. It basically prohibits federal troops from being used for domestic law enforcement. That being said, the National Guard can be called into cities and states under certain very specific emergencies, none of which apply here, and therefore it's illegal.
I mean, we saw him do it earlier this year in Los Angeles. As you know, that is still tied up in the courts, arguments ongoing about the legality of what happened down in L.A. I wonder, in your view, does the mere threat, the mere prospect of this start to have an impact on the city?
Sure. I think it causes people to be anxious. I think people are scared and fearful. I think that we should, you know, basically file lawsuits preemptively to declare this type of action to be unconstitutional and maybe get a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction. But let's be very clear about the purpose of this, which again is to distract from his mismanagement of the economy. And I think that he almost wants to provoke a spectacle and potentially violence, which would then justify further harsh measures on his part.
I mean, we've seen repeatedly in this and other arenas, President Trump does not appear to be particularly worried or particularly afraid of getting sued. And as I just mentioned, Los Angeles and what happened there is still tied up in the courts post facto. Practically speaking, if President Trump decides he wants to send the National Guard to Chicago, is there anything that local or state leaders can do to stop it?
Well, of course, he can do whatever he wants illegally, but that doesn't mean that these leaders should not go ahead and preemptively file lawsuits or lawsuits in due course, because at the end of the day, we want to, you know, make sure that the public is aware of the illegality and unconstitutionality of this. I think within Congress, we have to continue to press as well. And then I've introduced legislation as well to, you know, make the deployment of these types of troops illegal unless the chief executive of the jurisdiction at issue, in this case, the governor or the mayor, would consent to it.
I wonder, as you watch the current situation in the nation's capital, in Washington, D.C., where armed National Guard members are now patrolling the streets, anything you have seen in D.C., which is a special situation because it's a district, not a state, but anything you see in Washington that will inform how Chicago may respond?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's extremely important for anybody who decides they want to protest or express their opposition to what he does, or if there's a deployment of troops, to be very peaceful about doing it. The last thing in the world is to fall for the bait and potentially engage in escalatory actions, which is what Donald Trump would want. And I think the second thing is we have to be mindful that the people that are being deployed are good men and women. They've been called up to do their duty, so to speak, but they haven't been trained in domestic law enforcement. They have not been trained to do the things that are necessary to improve public safety. And indeed, I think the deployment of National Guard troops would do the opposite. It would probably worsen public safety.
Congressman, violent crime is down in Chicago over the first half of this year, same as in many big cities, but there is still crime. Could there be anything useful about having hundreds or even thousands of extra pairs of hands around to fight crime?
Well, let's hire more police officers if that's the issue. Let's you know, rely on the people that the community entrusts with their public safety. I don't think that bringing in National Guard troops or militarizing the situation improves the situation. I think it actually, you know, potentially causes the potential for an escalation that could lead to worse outcomes.
What are you hearing from your constituents? Is everybody talking about this or just getting on with daily life?
No, a lot of people are talking about it. They're very upset for two reasons. One, that, you know, this type of militarization of the situation could escalate into possible violence, which they fear Donald Trump wants. And then two, they're very upset that, you know, Donald Trump is not focused on the issues that bedevil them. You know, the fact that because of the tariff chaos that we see right now, businesses are actually laying off people. Or that, you know, as one woman told me, she couldn't afford her groceries and her electricity bills are going through the roof.
And last question, Congressman, when you make these points, when you lay out these arguments to the Trump administration, what do you hear back?
Silence. I think that they know that this is illegal, but I think that they are so desperate to change the conversation right now, they're willing to take even, you know, dangerous turns in doing so.
Congressman, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy, Democrat from Illinois. And in an earlier version of this story, we said we'd reached out to the Department of Homeland Security for comment. That is incorrect. We've reached out to DHS for comment on a separate story.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE-KBXE news team. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Gopher State OneCall reminds you to call 811 before you break ground on any project, whether it's as small as a mailbox or as large as a house. This help prevents accidents, power outages, and repairs. Call 811 48 hours in advance of any digging. Support for KAXE comes from the IM Hotel in Grand Rapids, providing access to local attractions and outdoor activities like fishing and bike trails. Additional information available at imhoteltimberlake.com. United Way of 1000 Lakes hosts the Lumberjack Mile and 5K Saturday, September 6th. Races begin at 9 a.m. at Grand Rapids Public Utilities with registration at 8. Proceeds benefit the United Way School Pantry Coalition, a network of 11 schools addressing student hunger with nutritious snacks and weekend meals. For more information, visit uwlakes.org/lumberjack. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University hosts a new retrospective exhibit of work by Marlee Cowell. There's an opening reception Thursday, September 4th from 4 to 7 at the gallery, located in Bridgman Hall on the BSU campus. This exhibit looks back at Cowell's 60-year artistic journey with some never-before-seen works. It'll be on display through October 30th.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In North Baltimore, there is a small body of water created by a dam. This is Lake Roland Park. It's a place where, as the pandemic upended everything, musician Marcus Brown would come to clear his head, literally to go touch grass or a tree.
You can have your own space. I would go on dates here. I would just come here during the wintertime alone, like a psychopath. Like, there's like a tree down here I love.
Marcus Brown grew up in a neighborhood nearby, though he says he didn't come here back then when it was known as Robert E. Lee Park.
But I think we just drove by it all the time. I was like, oh, there's a racist park.
The short version of what happened next. Brown moved away to music school, came back to Baltimore, left again for Los Angeles, came back to Baltimore again, and the whole time he was trying to make music. But to do it, he had to support himself with a slew of different jobs, working at a barber shop, a bookstore, a grocery store, teaching tennis as a videographer. And the one thing that broke through after nearly a decade was made during COVID, while he had COVID, literally in his parents' basement as a one-man band. He called the project Nourished by Time.
Just draining the sponge, you know, like the whole day I'm just living life, doing things, meeting people.
Brown described his work as a musician as being a conduit for what he's lived through. His job is to get his skills up to where he can just let his subconscious flow through him.
You don't want a vessel that sucks. You know, like if I'm a spirit trying to find a vessel, like in Space Jam, when like they were trying, like they found NBA players to take, like they didn't find me, you know what I mean? It's like, they're like, yeah, I'm gonna find Charles Barkley and take his body. Yes, yeah, it's the same thing.
The way his music comes out is hard to describe because it blends so many styles together. You can hear that on the new Nourished by Time album. It's called The Passionate Ones.
I saw you on my deja vu. You're running.
Marcus Brown recently moved to New York City, but we caught up with him here in Baltimore by the dam in Lake Roland Park.
You've said in other interviews that Baltimore is really at the heart of your music. You've described your music as working class music. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I say a lot of things I disagree with, even if I say sometimes. But like Baltimore definitely, I mean, it gave me so many experiences as a kid. I know what it's like to drop my friends off at like, you know, their home and it's just like a bunch of dilapidated, you know, homes, or like just go to my grandmother's house and it's just like the same street that's just been like run down. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, I know what it's like to go to like fancy French restaurants that are like 10 minutes away and like, you know, like all these other things. And I guess I never want to only minimize Baltimore as like a working class experience, but it definitely is a working class city. It's a post-industrial city, and I'm inspired by the people there, and I'm inspired by, like, yeah, some of the negative experiences that I've had here, but also, like, you're never gonna find, like, more creative and just more interesting and, like, intelligent people that probably don't know they're those things, that don't identify as that, like, but they are, you know.
As we're kind of having this conversation about labor and work and value, I do want to ask you about the song 9 to 5, because that so clearly is in that world. Can you tell us a little bit about the song?
So I was working at a Barnes & Noble for a year and a half, saved up like $5,000-$7,000. And then I moved to LA, and I moved here to be an artist. And now I'm realizing I can barely afford it, and I'm spending all my time going to work. When I get home, I have to record and like make music for at least 2-3 hours. And so I'm recording from, let's say, like 11 to 2, you know? And I'm just doing that every day, but I'm not really meeting people like I would rather be. And so, yeah, 9 to 5 was basically just like what I was going through when I was living in LA.
Oh, I love it, I hate the life, and I got two choices, either left or right.
Musically, I was just like, I wanted it to just be, everyone's like copying like Baltimore like dance music now, or like Baltimore club music. And I just wanted to like do it in a way that like I thought was genuine to me, but also like pushing the music forward. I wanted to do my version of like Dance My Pain Away.
Dance my pain away, I got problems.
You're saying real over the club beat. Like, Dance My Pain Away is like something like Bill Collectors. Like you know, like he's talking about like his family life. He's talking about just like pain. You know, the whole song is pain. And like, I always thought that was the balance of dance music. You know, like we're dancing, but we gotta earn it. You know, sometimes.
The album is called The Passionate Ones. Why'd you pick that name?
It's based off just like The Beautiful Ones. Prince's The Beautiful Ones from Purple Rain. I always was really struck by the title. But also just like The Passionate Ones is something it's very universal. You know, it's not, it's just really anyone with a dream or anyone with a fire in their heart about anything. And that's really who I'm talking to.
I wanna see you like a flower.
What has changed for you since your past albums came out? Has anything changed about your process? Do you still have total control over every bit of the music that you're creating in the way that you did when you started?
Yeah, creatively, yeah. I'm always just competing with myself in that regard.
What is it like having that level of control over your music, your creativity, the final product? Is it more daunting, freeing? Is it intimidating at times?
That's a really good question. I think for me, it was really important for these first few projects for it to be very DIY and for it to be like more relatable and more just like, you know, let's see how much we can do, you know, like with a concept. Even with the next album, like I'm probably gonna work with other people more. Like, it'll probably be more collaborative, like in the future, because like I'd never want to be just like an echo chamber of my own ideas and thoughts. And like, I can progress for sure, but like, I am seeing the pros and cons of collaboration.
How long are you? I've checked those bars, but I can't see my reflection.
Thank you so much for coming out and spending some time with us. This has been so fun.
Of course. No, yeah. Thanks for coming.
Musician Marcus Brown, his new album, As Nourished by Time, is called The Passionate Ones.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Olcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. Now for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Two people have died in an all-terrain vehicle crash in rural northern Carlton County on Saturday. The Carlton County Sheriff's Office says a 911 caller reported the crash just before 9:20 p.m. on Ditchbank Forest Road in Progress Township. 48-year-old Lisa Jo Westendorf of Cloquet and 59-year-old Glenn Allen Burdick of Homestead, Iowa were dead at the scene. Deputies learned they were separated from their group. A group member then found them with the side-by-side overturned in water in the ditch. CPR was attempted but was unsuccessful. The sheriff's office is investigating the crash. The mayor of a small Iron Range town was charged with two counts of felony theft last week. The Itasca County Sheriff's Office has spent the last year investigating a claim that Keewatin Mayor Michael Labine has been turning his water valve on and off without paying the associated fees. According to the criminal complaint, the investigation began on the initial report of a former deputy clerk and public utilities clerk. The clerk says the city charges a $100 fee every time the city turns someone's water on or off, plus another $10 per month user fee. Labine is the former city crew supervisor and allegedly knew how to use the key to turn water on and off. The complaint states Labine has a double lot and turned on the second valve in the spring when his family came to stay in a camper and turned it off when they left. He's allegedly done this for more than a decade and would owe almost $2,500 in fees. The clerk told investigators she didn't know why she didn't report the crime sooner. She says she is, quote, being bullied out of being on the city council and admitted to not getting along with Labine. Investigators spoke with multiple city staff who allegedly knew of Labine turning the water valve himself or had done it for him. The complaint says Labine believes the clerk is trying to get back at him and that he only turned the water on this year. Labine says it's not his fault he wasn't getting charged and blamed city staff. He faces two felony theft charges plus a gross misdemeanor for public officer misconduct. A Grand Rapids woman's criminal vehicular homicide case will remain in Itasca County. Cindy Martin allegedly hit and killed 19-year-old Carter Heathcock last summer on Highway 169 in Nashwalk and then left the scene. Judge Heidi Chandler denied Martin's request for a change of venue on Wednesday. Her lawyers had argued that pretrial publicity prevented a fair trial in Itasca County, in part because Martin is a prominent local DFL organizer. Prosecutors proposed measures to ensure a fair trial, including jury questionnaires and a larger-than-normal prospective juror pool. Chandler agreed an unfair trial wasn't likely with those in place. She acknowledged the, quote, inflammatory rhetoric that has been directed at Martin and noted many pro-prosecution attendees at each court appearance. But Chandler wrote news coverage of the case has not been massive and has been primarily factual. Chandler did leave open the opportunity for Martin to renew a change of venue request if new information arises. Martin is also seeking to dismiss the charge or suppress some evidence, with the judge's decision on those issues expected later this fall. Two Northern Minnesota organizations were selected to partner with the University of Minnesota. The university's Empowering Small Minnesota Communities program aims to prepare communities for pursuing government funds to bolster long-term resiliency. Tactical action projects focus on infrastructure needs. The Arrowhead Regional Development Organization is one of seven tactical action projects this year. The project will research the socioeconomic impact of transportation gaps to accessing healthcare in the Arrowhead. The White Earth Land Recovery Project is also part of the Tactical Action Group. It wants to renovate and revitalize the building, equipment, and satellite sites it owns, including community gardens and the Niji Radio Tower. The project also aims to incorporate the social, ecological, and technical needs of the community. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, morning show, and phonology teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from PBS with Clearing the Air, The War on Smog. American Experience explores how LA's noxious smog problem led to the creation of the EPA and the Clean Air Act. Tomorrow, Tuesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in New York.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. An NPR investigation has revealed a new member of the Justice Department's team looking into the alleged weaponization of law enforcement. He's an attorney who represented violent January 6 rioters. He called for reparations for those defendants and compared their prosecutions to the Holocaust. NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports.
It was the day after Trump's inauguration. Trump had just issued mass pardons for the people who were charged for attacking the Capitol. And the attorney, Jonathan Gross, was ecstatic.
It was an unbelievable thing to witness. It was biblical.
Gross represented several January 6 defendants, including violent rioters. He said Trump releasing them from prison was like Moses leading the Jews out of Egypt. And now, he said, it was time for the Trump administration to enforce consequences. Because in his mind, the prosecutors who brought the Capitol riot cases were no different than Nazi war criminals.
These prosecutors are evil people. They will put you on a cattle car to Auschwitz without an eye. I will tell you, some of them were scarier than others. The scariest ones of them are cold-blooded killers.
Just a few months later, Gross joined the Civil Rights Division of the Trump Department of Justice. He's working with the administration's Weaponization Working Group. That group is investigating the January 6th prosecutions, which Trump called a grave national injustice. The hiring of Jonathan Gross shocked some former Justice Department officials.
The DOJ that I grew up with, that I joined, and that I worked for 8.5 years would never have hired Jonathan Gross, let alone for a job like this.
That's Mike Gordon. He was a January 6th prosecutor. And like dozens of his colleagues, he was abruptly fired. He's suing the government over his dismissal. Gordon prosecuted one of Jonathan Gross's clients.
I took over Nancy Pelosi's office.
You may remember Richard Barnett as the guy who bragged about putting his feet on a desk in Pelosi's office and then called for war.
This is war. They're trying to take over our country.
Barnett was convicted of nonviolent felonies and misdemeanors for storming the Capitol while armed with a stun gun. Gordon faced off against Jonathan Gross during that trial. Just what were your impressions of him during that time?
That he was a pure ideologue who was in way over his head.
Before January 6th, Gross had never worked on any criminal cases. He was actually a rabbi for more than a decade before he decided to make a career change and got his law license in 2019. He did not respond to our requests for comment. He hung up on me when I called him. But he has said he took on the January 6th cases because he was personally outraged, not so much by the attack on the Capitol, but by the prosecutions of the rioters.
The real crime of January 6th was not what happened on that day. It's what happened since.
Gross argued that there was no serious violence on January 6th, despite the injuries suffered by 140 police officers. The Biden Justice Department had a near-perfect record of convictions in the Capitol riot trials, but Gross said on a podcast that was not because of overwhelming evidence, but bias.
Problem is that the juries and the judges don't care. The verdict is already determined in advance.
Gross argued that in addition to mass pardons, the riot defendants should receive reparations.
There has to be compensation. People's lives have been destroyed. And the way they can do that is they can just let everybody file a lawsuit and settle the lawsuits. They have to compensate people.
The Justice Department has now paid $5 million to settle a wrongful death lawsuit by the family of Ashley Babbitt, who was shot and killed during the breach. And the Trump DOJ says it is leading a fulsome investigation into the January 6th prosecutors, like Mike Gordon. He said hiring Jonathan Gross to help run that investigation sends a bad signal.
That what this weaponization, so-called weaponization working group is doing is actually weaponizing the government against its own employees.
Gordon pointed to another recent DOJ hire working on that investigation, a former January 6th defendant who urged rioters to kill cops on that day. Now he and Gross are inside the government, and Mike Gordon is left to wonder what happens next. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
President Trump signed an executive order to create specialized National Guard units, units that can be deployed to address public safety in cities across the country. This was one of several executive orders he signed today while also hosting a major world leader. The orders aim to give him more authority to crack down on domestic crime. NPR's Franco Ordonez is at the White House. He's following it all. Hi, Franco.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Tell me a little bit more about these executive orders and the significance of this law enforcement crackdown.
Yeah, Trump has been talking about expanding his anti-crime efforts for a bit. And here in Washington, of course, he deployed hundreds of National Guard troops and sought to take over the local police. And late last week, he said he would target Chicago next. Well, today he says the U.S. military is ready to go into any city to crack down on crime, but he's also hedging on going into Chicago right now without the support of local leadership, which he does not have.
We may or may not. We may just go in and do it, which is probably what we should do. The problem is, it's not nice when you go in and do it and somebody else is standing there saying, as we give great results, say, we don't want the military. They need help badly. Chicago desperately needs help.
And I'll just note that Trump does not have the same type of authority in Chicago or Illinois as he does here in Washington, D.C. But this is really just the latest example of how he's pushing the bounds of his executive authority.
In other news, he also signed orders today on cashless bail and flag burning. That last one, flag burning, is protected by the Constitution.
Yeah, I'll note that the specific order directs the U.S. Attorney General to prosecute those who burn or desecrate the flag in any way. Here's how he put it.
If you burn a flag, you get 1 year in jail, no early exits, no nothing.
And you're right, the Supreme Court ruled in 1989 that burning the flag was protected free speech. And Trump's order actually acknowledges the ruling, but argues that these acts can be prosecuted if, quote, it is likely to incite imminent lawless action. I'll just add that it's a different makeup of the Supreme Court than it was 30 years ago, a much more conservative court.
And what about the other one, cashless bail?
Yeah, cashless bail allows suspects to be released from jail without paying bond or money. Trump argues it creates more violence in the city. It lets dangerous people back on the streets. Today's order is aimed at ending cashless bail in D.C. Trump has criticized other cities for a cashless bail, too, like Chicago, like New York, and is pressing Congress for a nationwide ban.
And then, Franco, amid all these executive orders, this domestic news, he hosted the new president of South Korea. And there was some tension ahead of that meeting. Explain.
Yeah, there really was. I mean, ahead of the meeting, Trump painted South Korea as a nation in trouble, posting on social media that there was a, quote, purge or revolution taking place in South Korea. He even questioned whether the U.S. could do business with Seoul. But those tensions appeared to cool by the time the meeting happened, as the South Korean leader just showered Trump with praise. I mean, a lot of the talk was actually about North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The South Korean leader repeatedly flattered Trump, even telling him only he could bring peace to the peninsula.
And PR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
One of the latest fitness trends involves wearing a weighted vest as you walk around or hike. NPR's Katie Riddle asked if they even work.
Not only are weighted vests all over public parks and hiking trails lately, they're all over social media.
The benefits to walking with a weighted vest are insane.
This is from a TikTok account called The Ashley Will. She's a paid promoter of the weighted vest she wears.
Your posture, your bones, increased calorie burn, your strength, your endurance. Like, I could go on and on and on.
The truth is, there just aren't very many studies that look at the impact of using weighted vests. The ones that do exist don't offer proof of many of the benefits that social media influencers are claiming. Take strength building. Some studies show no improvement in strength or bone health from wearing a weighted vest. One small study that did show a benefit didn't make it clear if it was the vest or the exercise that made the difference. Lauren Colenso-Simple studies exercise science at McMaster University in Canada.
It's definitely not optimal when we compare it to more traditional forms of strength training.
Colenso-Simple says in order to truly grow stronger, walking or running with or without a vest isn't that helpful. Something like a bicep curl while holding a weight stresses a muscle through its full range of motion.
And that's the stimulus that is going to say, hey, let's incorporate more amino acids into the muscle and actually grow.
There's nothing wrong with wearing a weighted vest, she says, but she thinks the fervor around them is misleading.
My mom went to her endocrinologist the other week, and the endocrinologist said, you know, oh, have you considered a weighted vest? And I was floored.
Weighted vests are not on the list of things Monica Christmas advises for her patients. She's an OBGYN who specializes in menopause. That's a time when it's especially important for women to improve bone density and muscle strength.
I would tend to steer them towards things that I think would be maybe a better use of their hard-earned dollars.
Resistance training with weights, Pilates, exercises for balance are all things she regularly recommends for patients in this stage of life. She says she prioritizes exercises that have been proven to improve strength.
I always say, if you got to pick one in one day, you don't have enough time to do both, I'd pick the weight-bearing stuff. That's at least what I do for myself.
Weighted vests, she says, might technically add weight to your body, but they're just not as effective as more targeted resistance training. So are weighted vests good for anything? Roger Fielding studies exercise science at Tufts University.
It's certainly a reasonable approach to being more physically active.
Fielding points out that it takes more energy to walk with more weight. That means burning slightly more calories and more cardiovascular benefits.
It will increase your energy expenditure, your oxygen consumption. All those vascular responses will go up, and they'll go up proportional to how much added weight you're putting on.
All these experts stress that any exercise is better than no exercise, especially for older adults.
So if this will add a little bit of benefit, increase the intensity a little bit, and if it's something that motivates you to be more physically active, have at it.
In terms of buzzy fitness trends, says Fielding, he's seen far worse. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. The KXE Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota's farmers markets throughout our region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo to Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at kaxe.org. Support for KAXE comes from the Pines Restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids, hosting a late-night patio party until 1 a.m. immediately following Riverfest, featuring Asian street food, handcrafted cocktails, and more. Restaurant info available at thepinesmn.com. Happy Dancing Turtle near Pine River invites 4- and 5-year-olds to participate in the Tiny Turtles program this fall. Classes begin Monday, September 8th and continue twice a month through November. Classes are held entirely outdoors. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. The Itasca County Family YMCA will be closed for plumbing work now through August 27th. The outdoor courts will still be available. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a Medicare presentation Wednesday, September 3rd at 1 p.m. Learn about the plans available before open enrollment, which begins October 15th. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. It is rare that we can even say this, but the U.S. Open kicked off yesterday with chaos in the stands.
First serve. Ladies and gentlemen, because of the delay caused by an outside interference, first serve has been granted.
Those jeers and whistles you're hearing caused a 6-minute delay in a match between the unseeded French player Benjamin Bonzi and the 2021 champion, the 13th seed from Russia, Daniil Medvedev. The drama started when a photographer walked onto the court during gameplay. The umpire called for Bonzi to repeat his first serve, which he had previously missed, and Medvedev was furious, hurling insults at the umpire and inciting the crowd. Medvedev eventually lost the match. Matt Futterman is a senior tennis writer with The Athletic, covering the U.S. Open, and he joins us now from Flushing Meadows, New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you personally make of what happened in last night's match?
I made that it was the kind of thing that, you know, a tournament dreams of on a first day, in the sense that it's a headline-grabbing moment, internet-friendly moment, lots of videos buzzing around. What could be better for publicity at the start of a big event?
Definite drama. And you've written that tennis is undergoing a sort of shift in tone. Like you write, quote, at the U.S. Open, tennis etiquette no longer rules. Can you talk more about that? Like, I get this sport has always been a little bit louder, a little bit brasher in New York, but more broadly, what do you see changing in tennis?
I guess what I see is tennis trying, or at least some people in tennis, trying to make it a little less precious. Of course, look, sportsmanship is always going to be important and should be important. But, you know, there's the kinds of things that, you know, are just sort of pro forma in the NBA and the NFL. They just, like, they don't happen in tennis. And certainly star players like Ben Shelton and Francis Tiafoe, they really want it. I mean, these are like sort of brash Americans who grew up as, you know, massive sports fans. And there's sort of a growing cohort that believes that tennis could really use a little more NBA.
Yeah. Okay, well, this was just day one of the U.S. Open. Is there anything else that you are watching for besides more drama?
Well, we definitely want more drama. We'll start there. The other thing that I'm always watching at the U.S. Open is this amazing thing that happens in New York, because it's such a diverse city and there's just so many immigrant communities here. Really, just about every country is represented.
Absolutely.
You know, you have a moment like yesterday when Alexandra Ayala becomes the first Filipino woman to win a Grand Slam match. And it was just packed with, you know, there are Filipinos everywhere. So I think that's what makes tennis so different at the U.S. Open. It's all over the world. It's a pretty homogeneous crowd. And then it comes to New York and, you know, all bets are off.
Matt Futterman is a senior tennis writer with The Athletic. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tonight is the final night of The Fringe in Edinburgh, Scotland. It's one of the world's biggest theater and comedy festivals, billed as weird and creative and experimental. But 80 years on, has The Fringe gone mainstream? NPR's Lauren Freyer went to Edinburgh to find out.
Walking down Edinburgh's Royal Mile, there are acrobats, mimes. I just saw someone on stilts, a whole family dressed as what looked like bananas in yellow. And you get inundated with performers handing out flyers for something like 4,000 different shows.
It's a stand-up musical comedy show with puppets in it about me being the only comedian left alive after a nuclear war.
It's a sci-fi comedy musical that I wrote.
With my friend Devin, and he went through a divorce. So the title is called Devin Gray, May Divorce Be With You.
And he's dressed like a Jedi.
Yes,
you're in a bathroom.
He's dressed like a Jedi.
That was puppeteer Gabriel Featherstone, writer-producer Zena Wood, and divorcee Devin's buddy, David Cunningham. It's called Fringe because it began in 1947 on the free-for-all fringe, the margins of a more rarefied festival.
Edinburgh once again played host to thousands arriving for the 8th Festival of Music and Drama,
which it's now eclipsed. This year, Fringe sold more than 2.5 million tickets.
So I've been coming to watch a Fringe since 2011.
Marjolaine Robertson is a comedian from Scotland's Shetland Islands, a 12-hour boat ride from any comedy club. But she was raised on Fringe lore. Her dad told her about one particular Fringe show he saw in the 1970s or 80s.
And the show was meant to start, and nothing happened. And then this man starts eating cream crackers incredibly messily and noisily in the front row. Then the man's like, well, if no one else is going to do anything, I'll get up. And this man got up on stage, and Dad said he'd never seen anything like it. He felt so awkward and cringe and, like, embarrassment for this man. And then all of a sudden, he realised, this is the bit. This is the joke.
It was performance art, and the man chomping those cream crackers was Rowan Atkinson, later known as Mr. Bean. Fringe is where theater kids find kindred spirits, and sometimes fame. Past performers include the late Robin Williams and Lin-Manuel Miranda before Hamilton. It's where Phoebe Waller-Bridge developed Fleabag. But Robertson says the Fringe vibe is now under threat.
Whether you're an act or a visitor, it's so expensive. I'm scared about the working class.
There are corporate sponsors. Crowds are getting older, more affluent, even, dare I say it, mainstream. Take Zainab Johnson.
I'm going to do a cappuccino with almond milk, please.
She's used to red carpets. She had her own Amazon Prime comedy special. But this is her first Fringe.
This was drastically different. This is your footing the cost of everything, of your accommodations, your flight, the venue that you choose.
Wait, you have to rent the room?
Yeah.
She says she wanted to see what all the hype is about and to be what she calls an ambassador for America at a time when people abroad are really curious about our politics.
You know what America's like? It's like that family member who is, they drunk and they knocking over. But you're like, but no, my uncle's, he's a good uncle.
The opening line of her comedy show is, I've got a gun. And she explains why she feels like she needs it as a black Muslim woman in America and how she's not giving up on her country. Marjolaine Robertson, a comedian from far north Shetland, mixes ancient island folklore into her act.
There once was a young girl.
So she's attuned to stories. In the 14 years she's been coming here, even the ones people tell about Fringe have changed. They used to talk about starving artists sleeping in bathtubs out of dedication to the Fringe. Now people deride Edinburgh residents for cashing in and renting out those mythical bathtubs.
The Fringe is now, in many ways, the beast. What's that classic phrase? Like, you either die the hero or live long enough to become the villain.
Maybe, she says, artists just need to create a new fringe of the fringe. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Edinburgh.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Programming is supported by The Forge in Grand Rapids, offering a space where students